Good afternoon and welcome to the MoneyWeb Investor webinar entitled From Leper to Lazarus, Are the Good Times Back for Mining and Resource Companies? My name is Warren Dick and I'm the editor of MineWeb.com. And joining me on the webinar today is the founder of IntelliDex and the journalist who penned the article which examines this question in detail, Stuart Theobald. How are you today, Stuart?
I'm very good, Warren. All good.
Great. So just before we get into it, we're obviously live with the webinar format. And for the benefit of our audience that hasn't yet read the article, if you want to do so at a later time, you can go to the moneyweb.co.za website and click on the MoneyWeb Investor icon located on the top right-hand side of the homepage. And that will take you straight into this month's edition of the article in which Stuart evaluates these questions and something we're going to do a little bit more of. Also, the benefit of the webinar is obviously that we can have an interactive session with some of the audience. So for those of you that have signed in there on the right-hand side or the bottom right-hand side of the webinar template, you'll see there's a space there where you can enter questions and we'd encourage you to ask those questions almost from the get-go so we can get those questions into Stuart over the course of the next half an hour. So I guess, Stuart, just to kind of set the context a little bit, but I think everyone's kind of familiar with what's happened. We saw a dramatic sell-off in commodities and the equity of commodity and mining companies last year. I've got a couple of the commodity prices up for us today just to kind of set the context. Brent oil after that Doha meeting over the weekend has slipped to $41 a barrel. Spot gold is at $1,237 an ounce. Platinum at $981 an ounce. Zinc, some of the base metals, zinc at $1,873 a ton, tin at $17,155 a ton, copper at $4,808 a ton. Stuart, you alluded to the massive recovery that we've seen this year, the 60% gain in the JSE mining index since the start of the year. Tell us where you see the market at the moment.
When you talk about the pain that the market has experienced, and it's been very real pain, but one of the consequences of that environment is that companies react, and the companies that are able to effectively react and shift their economics in order to be able to deal with a world in which commodity prices are lower, those are the companies that we've seen some good recovery from. So companies like Assore, Kumba Iron Ore, Lonmin, the other platinum producers, even Anglo American, has had a sharp recovery so far this year. Now, in part that's been because there's been a bit of life in commodity prices themselves. Iron ore, platinum up kind of 20% in the case of platinum. So there has been that underlying movement in commodity prices, but what's really been driving a bit of green on the exchange has been the restructuring these companies have been going through, really shifting the scale of their businesses, shifting their cost economics so that they can survive a sustained lower commodities price environment, and not only survive, but actually be able to remain profitable. And if those companies have been able to get that right, that we've seen these strong recoveries from.
Stuart, is it not a case of it was so brutal, the sell-off, and I guess the position, the balance sheet position of some of these companies was completely inappropriate for the environment that they found themselves in the second half of last year. Is this not change that's been brought about because they had to, because they really had to adjust? Otherwise, they were literally, and we'll get to Lonmin in the next few minutes, but they had to change or else they were going to go belly up.
So certainly, the problem with the commodity cycle and running a commodities company, a mining company, is that there's this huge lag between the signals you're getting from the spot market on commodity prices and how you're able to control your supply and production rates. So if you take a mine like Kumba, while iron ore prices are at very high levels, the decisions are made to invest in expanding capacity, and very large amounts of CapEx spending are committed to in order to expand capacity. But by the time that extra capacity comes online, the price might well have moved. And this is the dynamic we saw across the market, where up until 2008, you had a lot of very aggressive expansion investment happening, a great deal of money being spent on capital expenditure. 2008 triggers a economic recession. A lot of those decisions are, or at least not quite reversed, but no further expansion is promised. But by that stage, commitments have already been made. Once you pull the trigger and you start developing, you often don't have the option of simply ceasing the project in mid-phase. It's a sunk cost, and you've got to get through to the production end to be able to recover any of that capital expenditure. So we went through a cycle of a great deal of supply coming into the market. If you look at, say, a market like iron ore, there have been some absolutely massive iron ore developments that have come into the market over the last few years. And that massive supply response is really a response to the price signals that we had seen back in 2008. But that lag effect plays itself out. So the supply hits as you hit a falling demand scenario. So you just have a massive excess supply and very weak demand at exactly the wrong time for a lot of these companies. But now that they've been through that phase of those sunk costs having now been borne, they can respond. So we're seeing big cutbacks in capital expenditure where they can, big shifting of production out of high-cost mines, wherever possible, putting high-cost mines into care and maintenance, basically mothballing them, and focusing production on where it's cheapest to do so. So you're seeing the average costs of the industry coming down in order to deal with weaker global prices. And that's what we're now seeing driving the underlying economics of these companies.
I mean, that's the fundamental question. And let's get to specifically into Anglo American here, because there seems to be a lot of different views around the way Mark Cutifani has managed his time at Anglo. This is a company that obviously 20 years ago was the bluest of blue chip companies on the JSE. It was one of the biggest mining houses in the world. It seems to have lost its way over those 15 years, but Mark has come out with a very strong plan to shut down that or reduce the size of that portfolio. Give us your take on what you think he's done there, and if this is a right time to invest in Anglo American.
I'm probably on the side of the fence that thinks Mark has done a fairly good job there. The turning point for the company was really the December announcement of a restructuring plan. It's really going to see Anglo being dramatically remade. This is not going to be anything like that blue chip South African giant of old. It's going to become a much smaller company, but a company that's more dynamic and more profitable. So you're going to see it reduce its portfolio of assets. I think there's about 29 assets that are now on the block to be sold.
Right.
It's going to leave it with only about 16. So much more focused business. It's going to end up really just being in diamonds, platinum, and some copper. So more streamlined. And really what's being put up on the block for sale is pretty much every asset that's not cash flow positive. So any asset that it has in its portfolio that can't turn an operating profit right now with prices as they are is up for sale. So what you're going to be left with is a company that's guaranteed to be profitable at prices where they are. Now, the big unknown is really how successful it's going to be in offloading all those assets. You might think, naturally, who wants to buy a loss-making portfolio of mines right now? But there are people out there in the market, and as we've seen, great examples historically, that new management can bring new life to old assets, and a new approach can turn loss-making assets profitable. And there might well be those kinds of buyers out in the market who will be very interested in the Anglo portfolio and already be engaging on trying to see what deals can be done.
We just two comments to that I'd put to you. One is that obviously Marcus, I think he's been there a fair amount of time already. I think it's coming up for about 3 years. So one of the criticisms investors were saying when they initially heard that restructuring plan is that it wasn't doing enough. They weren't moving quick enough in trying to get those assets, trying to raise cash for those assets. And the second one ties into the question here from a member of the audience is, you know, that they put off doing a rights offer last year. They've kind of pinned their mast to the sail in terms of raising the cash through asset sales. You know, if someone buys into Anglo now, do you think they are going to avoid doing a rights offer? You think this is an environment that they can get some of these larger assets out for decent amounts of cash?
Well, they're targeting raising about $4 billion from asset disposals. And as I say, I'm reasonably optimistic that they're going to find some demand in the market for those assets. They decided they don't need to do the rights offer, so that really came about following the restructuring plan. And it's only in a scenario in which they really do fail to meet their targets for the cash they can generate from the sales that you're going to see any kind of rights offer. I think there's a very low probability of that. So I don't think one should avoid the share out of fear that some big dilution is going to come. I know the absolute nightmare scenario is a Lonmin-type scenario where existing shareholders are pretty much diluted out of existence. Nothing like that is on the table for Anglo American tonight. And I'm reasonably confident that they will avoid any sorts of rights issue because they are going to be reasonably successful in generating cash from the sales. Now they also have their existing portfolio that is cash flow positive, that's continuing to generate profits. That money is all going to be focused on reducing the company's debt load. So this is all part of a balance sheet repair job that's going to position the company in a much more stable debt-to-equity ratios where it'll be a much lower risk proposition. But it needs to get to that outcome. Now, if it can do that, and I think it will do that without a rights issue, then shareholders are safe. They're in a business that is going to be cash flow positive, that will be profitable, and there certainly is not going to be any need for a rights issue.
A smaller Anglo, Stuart, does that mean someone might come and buy that ultimately? I mean, we saw Glencore try to do the merger a few years ago, but we're talking about, as you said, a greatly reduced portfolio size for Anglo American. Does that make them a target for anyone else?
Well, I think we've got to see a sustained change in the commodity cycle before that sort of M&A interest is going to arise again. In an environment like this, everybody is focused on remaining as bulletproof as possible. They want tough balance sheets. They don't want to be raising capital to do acquisitions. They're really hunkered down. I think when the time comes for M&A activity again in the market is when we're going to see sustained increases in demand. We really need to see the global economy in better shape with an upward growth trajectory. We need to see easier access to capital for these companies. And then we're going to see M&A activity, and a business the size of Anglo is probably a good candidate for an acquisition. And that kind of scenario, I think, is somewhat comforting for an investor going into the business now. I would say that's a 5 to 10 year view where you have an underpin of value looking at a stronger demand scenario worldwide for commodities pushing prices up. That's going to significantly enhance the profitability of a business like this. It is a potential acquisition target, which provides a value underpin. You know, in any investment, the market will price it on its belief about the fundamentals. But at the end of the day, it's what a trade buy could do where the real upside lies, particularly for mining companies. And we've seen that time and time again. It's really when a major transaction comes into the market that shareholders really see reap the returns. So I kind of have that in the back of my mind on a 5 to 10 year view that might well be the future for Anglo.
Okay, great. Just a reminder to our audience that they can ask and submit questions via the webinar panel on the right-hand side. So please send us your questions. I've got one here from a member of the audience, Stuart, for you. I'm intrigued by the fact that Anglo is elected to stay in copper. Why copper isn't the future platinum?
It's interesting. Copper is that kind of, they call it Dr. Copper. It's a real bellwether of the global economy. And it's a commodity that's been really damaged by China's slowdown in growth. So you would think it would be a bit unpopular at the moment. But Anglo has got a long history. It's got pretty decent assets in this business. It knows what it's doing. It has a very low-cost operation, a lot in South America, so Los Broncos and in Chile and elsewhere. These are good businesses at the lower cost end of the market. So because these are cash positive, even at the current prices, it makes sense for the company to stay there, and that's the decision that's made. So if you look at a global copper production industry, if you're in the lower ends of the cost curve, that's a comfortable place to be. The place you don't want to be at is the higher ends of the cost curves. That's where you want to be getting out. So Anglo's business fits into that scenario, and copper remains a good place for it to be.
And similar, obviously, copper to diamonds, and the fact that there hasn't been a lot of new diamonds or copper discoveries made, or at least not ones of large scale.
Yeah, so I guess copper is a bit unlike iron ore in that respect. The supply side hasn't grown at quite the same pace. It's still grown, but you're talking about a couple of percent a year rather than tens of percents a year. And copper is, as I say, that sort of foundational economic commodity that any economy that's growing, the one certain thing they're going to be consuming is more copper. So in that respect, it's probably somewhat lower risk, because it is ultimately something that is consumed in economic activity. It's not something that, say, diamonds sits at, which is, we could quite healthily survive if no more diamonds are bought, whereas copper has a fundamental demand base that is just never going to go away.
Okay, great. Let's turn our attention to Lonmin for a little while. We obviously we had a lot to say about Lonmin last year. We wondered whether it had any equity value at all around September, October, November. They subsequently did the rights issue. When you look at the terms of that rights issue, Stuart, a lot of that money went to paying down debt to the funders and reorganizing debt, as well as to the costs of underwriting the issue and various other linked corporate events. Have Lonmin done enough with the rights issue, and have they done enough in terms of restructuring the business to make sure that they are viable at the current prices?
Yeah, Lonmin. Lonmin effectively was taken over by its bankers. It had broke all its debt covenants, and the bankers moved in there. And their primary objective was to protect the debt in the business. And the rights issue that was done there was, in effect, a sale of the business, because it was at such a scale. That the dilutionary effect meant that the existing shareholders were diluted almost out of existence. So, what Lonmin went through, I think, is a nightmare scenario for any mining company, where they're in such a dire straits from a cash perspective that they, in effect, have to be entirely recapitalized. So, we saw that happen. We've seen the business now. Much stronger balance sheet, has managed to get the bankers off its back, and it's now focused on improving its operating position, and it's doing so very aggressively. So we've seen some major cost cuts, some quite dramatic cuts to the workforce there, and this all works to bring the economics back into a cash flow positive position. So we're sitting with platinum price of just under $1,000 an ounce, and Lonmin's aim is to get its costs to about 10,800 rand an ounce. So you can see that when you're sitting with the rand at about 14.70 to the dollar, it's going to be able to generate close to 14,000 rand an ounce, while its costs are now under 11,000 rand an ounce. So that's what Lonmin's been doing, and achieving operating profits. Now, I've still got debt to pay, so it doesn't necessarily mean those profits end up in the hands of shareholders. But it does mean that it's a business that's now sustainable, as opposed to a business that was just bleeding red ink everywhere. And as a result, the share price has priced that in. So I think it hit a low in January of about 870 rand, and you know, now it's way back up over 320. So it's over 3,200. I mean, so it's been a hell of a good bet if you did happen to get into it at that bottom. But this was a business that was totally decimated by the rights issue, but has now focused on getting the operating story right, and it looks like it's succeeding.
The question is, I mean, there's obviously a lot of investors here, and there's a couple of questions coming through on the system about this, but you've obviously seen a massive bounce already. In the article, you actually detail how, let's just using Anglo American and Lonmin, for example, at the start of last year, the start of 2015, Anglo American share price at 213 Rand. It bottomed out in mid-January this year at 53 Rand 30. Now, as you say, I think it's up to about 125 or closer to 150, I think. Lonmin.
Well, it was at 140 today, yeah.
Yeah, 140 Rand. Lonmin, 316, was at 3160, I think. 3160 in January 2015. Hit its lowest at 8 Rand 70 in January this year. And I think that was after the 100-to-1 consolidation. So the question investors are saying is, well, we suffered through the downturn. Prices have now rebounded. What about today? Do we get in?
This is a hard question. Now, we talked a bit about how these companies have managed to fix up their operating models, fixed up balance sheets, turned themselves cash flow positive at current prices, right? I think they've done a very good job. So I think these companies we've talked about, at least, you know, running a mine in a tough environment like this is never easy. And when you look at the results, you can see that management has managed to turn things around. The scenario for what happens from now really depends on those underlying commodity prices. Worldwide, commodity producers are all shifting their economics. And there's only one way to do that. It's to reduce supply. And as supply is pulled out of the market, prices inevitably are going to be rising. Now, if we just look at the example of Lonmin, what it's done is shut down four of its 11 shafts. So you can see how that reduces output. And it's just one example of what mines are doing worldwide to try and shift their economics. So you shut down your higher cost operations and focus on where commodities are cheaper to produce, maybe cheaper, easier geology to access, nearer the surface, what have you. So that supply reduction has an effect worldwide on prices. And it's obviously in a positive direction. And that's certainly what's contributed to the recovery in underlying commodities so far this year, as the market realizes that the supply has fundamentally shifted. But what we do also need to see is the story on the demand side. And I think that's where the scenario is a bit tougher to feel confident about. It really depends on China. Now, China consumes something like half of the commodities that are produced in the world. So
right.
It is what drives commodity prices. And China was growing its consumption of commodities at sort of 20% compounded through the late 2000s. Its demand was strong and growing aggressively. So that's what was driving all those capital expenditure decisions to massively expand supply. That growth rate has declined substantially. So even though China's GDP is growing at still, you know, pretty over 6% at a healthy rate.
Right.
Really, its consumption of key commodities, like, say, copper, is now only growing at about 2%. And remember, China does have some domestic sources in some of these commodities. So its demand for commodities being produced in the rest of the world is weaker if with growth rates at that kind of level. So the question as to the long-term scenario here is, what is that growth rate going to be like for China? Now, when you look at what people are forecasting, key voices like Goldman Sachs, HSBC, who study the market very closely, and they only see supply growing, or they see demand in China growing by all of them by below 10%, nothing like the growth rates that we did see in the 90s or in the late 2000s that really drove the performance of these commodity prices. So that's how the world looks. You've got supply kind of being reduced as higher cost operations are taken offline, but you've got demand still ticking over at something like 2% growth rates compared to what had been 20% growth rates
a few years ago.
Yeah. So what kind of scenario is very positive here? Well, if China does pick up, that's one story. But of course, the rest of the world could also help us out here in its own economic performance. So if we do see the U.S. recovery becoming entrenched, if we see better signs of life in Europe, in Japan, in the rest of Asia, that is a scenario which is going to be extremely positive for the demand side and is going to be more positive for prices. But I think we're never, ever going to see the peaks that we did see back in the last decade, simply because the global production side has changed fundamentally. So even when, as soon as prices recover to the point where it becomes viable to reopen all those operations that are currently being taken out of the market, they come back on stream. And that provides a much lower price cap as there was a decade ago when supply fundamentally was more constrained. You now have a supply side that's more elastic, that's more responsive to movements in underlying prices, and it'll keep underlying prices at lower levels than we saw back then. So we're never, ever going to see as good a time as we did a decade ago. But we can still see pretty strong returns to shareholders. So in a scenario where you have our producers producing at profitable, stable, sustainable levels with strong balance sheets, and you see some global support. So we just need the global economy to become more sustainable and a stronger trajectory, then we'll see the demand side providing the support. And that's really a comfortable position to be in. You want demand to be ticking up without smashing through any ceilings, and you want a supply side that's efficient and cash flow positive. In that scenario, which is probably my base case, that's what I think is something investors can rely on a 1 to 2 to 5 year scenario. That's a healthy outlook for these companies, and on that basis, I think that it's worth taking an option on that scenario. So it's worth adding something to a portfolio that allows you to participate when that scenario comes. But it's never going to be the kind of market that we saw 10 years ago.
Well, yes, Stuart, I guess I think we've kind of come to the end of the webinar and the interview, so thank you very much for your time. It certainly seems to be that the expectations of growth are certainly not priced into some of these companies at the moment. So as you say, possibly a very kind of realistic time to get into some of these shares.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Stuart, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We hope to catch up with you with you soon again. And for the benefit of our audience, if you haven't had the chance to read Stuart's article in The Investor this month, go to the moneyweb.co.za website and click on the icon for The Investor. That'll take you into April's edition, and you'll see there Lena and Mina and Stuart's take and his analyst's take on some of these companies, including Anglo American, Kumba, Assmang, and Lonmin. And that is the end of the webinar. So thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to hosting you again soon.